talks about RSA and is scheduled for the talk. Well, first of all, we will start with an introduction to a method for solving polynomial equations via lattices. And this is also known as the Coppersmith method, and you can view this first part of the talk as a tutorial part. So I will introduce univariate polynomial equations in the modular case, and we will see how to solve them. And later on, I will tell you how to generalize this to multivariate equations and to the integer case. The second part of the talk is kind of an overview part. We will address the most interesting problems for RSA, namely inverting the RSA function, so taking eth roots, computing the RSA secret key, and factoring. And you all know none of these problems is feasible at the moment. So what we do is we relax these problems such that they become feasible in a certain way. So the question is, how far is this relaxation? Okay? And the last part is, well, the research part. I will show you three new attacks on RSA with small CRT exponents. So now D is not small in this case, but D has a small interpretation as D modulo P minus 1 and D modulo Q minus 1, and then you use the Chinese remainder theorem, and we have three relaxations in this case. So the first is we look at small e. The second case is we assume that we know the difference of dp and dq, and we'll see that we get this bound here. So think of n as a 1,000-bit modulus. Then we can recover in polynomial time dp and dq as long as they are smaller than 99 bits. Right? And the last one is the most interesting because it's a general case. We don't have the restrictions of small d and no difference. And in fact, we can recover dp and dq as long as we are smaller than this bound here. And this is a very new result. Actually, it's in progress, this result. So you see there are some problems, but we also have some experiments that tell us that the result is correct. So let's start with a tutorial on Coppersmith method. So as I said, it's a lattice-based method, so I have to introduce lattices to you. And here's the most simple framework. So we have n vectors in n-dimensional space, integer space. And lattice is simply all integer linear combinations of these vectors. Right? And here's an example. So you have a basis 0, 2, 1, 1. And the basis and the lattice is simply the grid spanned by these lattice vectors. So this point, this point, this point, this point, and so until infinity. Right? So if you have one basis, so bases of a lattice are not unique, you can change your basis by applying a Judy modular transformation, and this is what I've done here in the picture. So here's another basis of the same lattice. And as I said, it's a unimodular transformation, so what remains invariant is the determinant of the basis matrix. And this determinant of the basis matrix has also a geometric interpretation, namely, it's a region of this parallel epipate here. So this region here is the same as this region here. Right? And you already see that you can easily compute the determinant of a lattice, since you can compute the determinant of the basis matrix here. And you see that the shortest vector is related to this determinant. Namely, the shortest vector is one side length of a parallelogram. And in this case, it should be upper bounded by the square root of the determinant. And in nth dimension, it should be upper bounded by the nth root of the determinant. Okay? And you can also give a constructive version in dimension 2. In dimension 2, everything is easy. And here you have the Lagrange algorithm, which is also known as the Gauss algorithm. It mainly depends who teaches you this algorithm. So in Germany, it's usually the Gauss algorithm, but I learned that it's actually Lagrange. So if you have a two-dimensional lattice, then you can find a non-trivial shortest vector. So non-trivial means it's not a zero vector, which is always in the lattice. And this vector is smaller than, well, the root of the determinant. And here's some factor of square root of 2. But during all this talk, I will be very sloppy with factors, with constant factors. And the deal is because we are computing roots in a certain interval, it's very easy to see that if you can compute the roots in a certain interval, you can double your interval. So what you do with a large interval, you just split it in two small intervals and compute the root separately in each interval. So we forget about constants in this talk. And in dimension n, you also have an algorithm which gives you an approximate shortest vector. So you input a lattice basis v1 up to vn. You get in polynomial time another basis b1 up to bn, and polynomial time in here means polynomial in the dimension of the lattice and in the size of the entries of your basis matrix. And this shortest vector that you get, which is called a cube vector because this is Lenzner, Lenzner and Lobas from 82, this shortest vector satisfies the following inequality. It's smaller than some term times the nth root of the determinant. So that's what you expect. But some people say this is an exponentially bad factor, but notice it's only exponential in the dimension of the lattice. It's not related to the representation size of your basis matrix. And that's actually good, because in every application that we have, we will just neglect this here. And whenever you see an epsilon in this talk, it will mean that this is this term here. Okay? So that's all we need to know about lattice. That's good. So we can just go to Coppersmith method. So the problem in Coppersmith method is the following. You're given an integer n. You can think of an RSA modulus, for instance, and a divisor b of m. So think of p, for instance. And one important special case is where the divisor is itself m. You know it. Okay, and the problem is you're given a univariate polynomial and you want to find all small roots of this polynomial, namely all x naught such that we satisfy this equation. So of course the goal is to maximize this upper bound x here. Find roots as large as possible. And well, it's somehow a little bit counterintuitive because you have a divisor b of m, but you don't know the factorization of m. But if you think a little bit about it, whenever you need this, you can just compute this modulo n, and whenever this equation holds modulo n, it holds modulo every divisor. So it's not a trick. Okay? And the idea how to get it is the following. First, you define a collection of polynomials. You fix some small m here. You define a collection of polynomials f1 up to fn that all has the same small roots modulo b to the m. So for instance, you can think of f1 being fb to the m's power, and f2 fb to the m's power times x, and so on. This is just one way how to define your collection. There are several ways, and in fact, this is one of the problems of Coppersmith method. Once you have your polynomial, you have to define your collection, and that's an optimization problem. Okay? So once you have this, you know that all of these have the same roots modulo b to the m. Now you define integer linear combinations, so you know that every integer linear combination has the same roots, because if you plug them in, all the exponents are zero. So you're searching for one special integer linear combination such that it's zero also with the integers. And the sufficient condition is it must be an absolute value smaller than b to the m. Because you know, if you plug it in your x naught, then it's a multiple of b to the m. Now the only multiple of b to the m which is an absolute value smaller than b to the m is 0 times b to the m. And once you have this, you are done. Okay? That's the whole trick. So once you understand this slide, you'll understand everything of Coppersmith method. And that's it. Okay? And afterwards, if you have this here, you can just solve it over the integers just by some standard root algorithm. Now, this condition is not very good because you don't know this x naught. You cannot really check this condition, but you already see it's related to lattices because you have integer linear combinations of polynomials. Now, you interpret your polynomials as coefficient vectors, and then you come to lattices. So here's exactly the lattice condition. So you have the same, you have a polynomial degree n minus 1. You know that it's 0 modulo b to the m up to some upper bound. And, well, this is our new condition. It says that if you look at the coefficient vector of fxx and take the Euclidean norm, then it should be smaller than b to the m times something small. Okay, so forget about the square root of n. And, well, here's an example of what this notion means. So if you have this polynomial, then fxx is this here, and the coefficient vector is ax squared bx squared. So instead of evaluating the polynomial itself, you somehow evaluate at its upper bound, and that's it. Right? So, and here's the proof of the theorem. It's also quite easy. And you see the proof of it, the theorem implies that fx0 is smaller than b to the n, which is exactly the condition that we had on the last slide. So we just plug it in, this triangle inequality, this is an upper bound for x0, so we end up with this term here, and now this is exactly the one norm of this coefficient vector. Now going to the two norm, you lose a factor of square root of n, and that's it. Okay? So that's exactly our lattice space formulation of the condition. So whenever we have a polynomial, we switch to the coefficient vectors, we put them into the lattice, and later on we switch again back to the polynomial representation. So let's see an easy example of this. So suppose you want to find an inverse a to the inverse of a modulo b. Okay, we all know how to find an inverse. Just apply the extended Euclidean algorithm, but for now I think we don't know the extended Euclidean algorithm. So what we want to solve is the following polynomial equation. We want to solve ax is 1 modulo b, and GCD of ab is 1, so we have a solution. So the first polynomial of our collection is the polynomial itself. So we translate this polynomial here, and we have an upper bound for the root, because we know the root is defined mod b, so the upper bound is b itself. And the second polynomial in our collection is the polynomial bx, and I pretend it has the same roots, mod b, because it's a zero polynomial, mod b. So it has every root, mod b. Right? Okay, now going from this collection, from the polynomials to the coefficient vectors is this. So we put these coefficient vectors into a lattice spaces. So we have lattice spaces spanned by the rows of the spaces matrix. And you see the determinant of this lattice is the absolute value of the determinant of b. So it's b times x, which is b squared. Right? And we already know, if we now apply lattice reduction, which means the Lagrange algorithm, we get a vector which is roughly the square root of this. So it's roughly of size b. So let's do this. We apply Lagrange algorithm. We get the coefficient 0, c0, c1, and a vector which is roughly of size b. And now we translate the coefficient vector back to the polynomial. So we get a polynomial c0 times this row here is this, and c1 times this is this. And according to Hauck-Raffel-Kraemann theorem, we have to find a vector which is norm smaller than b to the m over square root of n. Now m is in our case 1. And we forget about the square root of n, which is square root of 2 in our case. So we are a little bit sloppy with constants. And we know that in this case, if we plug in our 0, then it evaluates to 0 over the integers. And you see in this case, for this equation now, we just have one unknown, namely x0, so we can simply solve for x0. And that's it. So we get our inverse of a modulo b. And if you look a little bit closer, then you see that C0 and C1 are exactly the coefficients that you get from the extended Euclidean algorithm. So it's a well-known fact that in dimension 2, everything is the same. Lattice reduction, continued fractions, and extended Euclidean algorithm. So in fact, the inverse is here in the C1. Okay? So this was an application of Coppersmith's algorithm in the univariate modular case. So now let's generalize it to the arbitrary number of variables. So the goal is to find the roots of a polynomial in n variables modulo b. And what we do is, instead of computing just one polynomial that evaluates at the small root to zero over the integers, we compute n polynomials. And later on, we cancel out the variables by resultant computations. Or in this case, you could also take Hübner bases, for instance. So, and for the integer case, it's pretty much the same. You want to find roots of a polynomial in n variables of a set. You compute n minus 1 polynomials with the same roots over set such that this S, this original polynomial, does not divide your Fi, because otherwise it's simple to compute these Fi and these are trivial. Okay? And there's also a lattice space formulation of Coron which gives you a condition under which this is satisfied. And later on you eliminate the variables by resultant computations. So if you are familiar with this elimination theory, you know that there is a serious problem with that. Namely, the first problem is we have to find optimal collections. Well, that's what I already stated. It's a combinatorial problem. The second one is this elimination step here and here requires that the polynomials that you get are algebraically independent. So it means that you can really eliminate one variable step by step and you end up with a univariate equation and then you can solve by back substitution. And this is not satisfied, it's a heuristic. So we just apply L-cube algorithm and we hope that they are algebraically independent in some sense. We only know that they are linear independent because they come from some lattice spaces. Actually, this heuristic works quite well in practice, but well, it would be nicer to have a theorem or something like this. So now that we know how Coppersmith's method works, let's see some examples how we really define these polynomials for the problems that we are interested in. So here's the RSA problem. Let's think of n always as being 1,000 bit, pq 500 bit. Well, c is m to z mod n, and of course we want to invert this function, so we want to find the unique m in set n. So the first relaxation is actually very trivial. So if m is smaller than n to the 1 over e, you see that you don't have a wraparound here. So you are not working on your n, but over the integers. So it's very simple. You just compute the e-th root of c and you are done. So the question is, can you do a little bit better? And yes, you can. So, and here's somehow the inhomogeneous case of this attack. So what happens if m itself is not small, but you know the most significant bits of m? And the least significant bits that you don't know are exactly of the same size as here. So in this case, Coppersmith has shown in 96 that you can also solve this, and this is exactly the method that we have seen. So you have a univariate polynomial equation and you solve for x, and that's it. Okay? And the last relaxation is a little bit different from these because we are mainly interested in polynomial time attacks. And the last one is not polynomial time, but it does not have this restriction of a small e, so the relaxation is that m is, well, upper bound by 2 to the k, and it's splittable. So you can write this m1 times m2, and they are both the same size. And what you do is you're using just the multiplicative property of RSA, and you're doing a birthday attack. Okay. So this was the RSA problem. So let's come to the problem of computing D, because we know D is a tractor for RSA. Maybe that's simple if you have some relaxations here. So same setting, we want to find D now, such that E times D is 1 modulo of N. We write this as a polynomial equation. So one of the problems is always find the right polynomial equation to start with. And this is really a problem sometimes. So the polynomial equation that we use here is E times D is, well, 1 modulo phi of n, phi of n written in this form here, n plus 1 minus rest, p plus q, and you already see that p plus q is somehow small compared to n. So it somehow tells you it's you want to find small roots of a polynomial equation. And you also see if you choose a small d, then k is also small. So every unknown here, every one of the blue guys is small. So we have a hope to solve it by Coppersmith's method. And indeed, Wiener did it by two-dimensional lattice reduction. That's the same that we have already seen. And this is, you can see it as a special case of Coppersmith's method, and showed that as long as d is smaller than 250 bits, 1,000 bit n, then you can factor in polynomial time. That means you can recover all these dk and p plus q minus 1. And Bonnet and Darcy, 7 years ago, showed that you can improve this bound to 292. And in fact, both use this equation here. Wiener reduces mod n, and Bonedaffi reduces mod e, and that's it. It's strange that it took 9 years to get the second result, actually, if you see it this way. And now you can also ask what happens if you know parts of D. So D itself is not small, but you know the upper most significant bits as before. And here is a result of Ernst, Jochens, myself, and Ben de Vega, and I will show you a graph on the next slide. But just as you remind, there was a third relaxation on the last slide, the properties of D, smoothness and squizzable. It's not really clear whether you get a polynomial time attack if you have these properties on D. That would be an interesting problem. Oh, let me show you the picture. Maybe it becomes clear. So here's the picture. Here's the size of D in terms of the size of n. So if n is 1,000 bits, that means D is 100 bit, 250 bit, 300 bit, and so on. And here's the fraction of D that you have to know. So we have already seen that if D is smaller than 250 bits, you can apply Wiener and you are immediately done. So you don't have to know nothing of D. And this Bonedaffi bound, and you see, if you are slightly beyond this bound, you just have to know a small fraction of D, and then you can also factor. And you see it somehow scales up until the point where D is full size, and in this case you have to know everything of D. Does that answer your question? So if D is a little bit larger, you have to know a larger fraction of the most significant bits of D. And that's it. So if D is like, let's say D is 500 bits, then this says you have to know half of the bits of D. That means you have to know 250 bits of out of the 500 bits. And that's it. Okay, so I don't know whether this graph here is reasonable function, so it consists of three different attacks, but at least the starting point and the end point are somewhat reasonable. So I don't know how to improve this. Okay, so the last problem, maybe from a polynomial point, is a very simple problem, namely it's a problem of factoring. And, well, the problem is given this, find this. Okay, and the polynomial that you have is the polynomial f is equal to x mod p. You already have seen you can work with divisors of your n. It's not a problem in Coppersmith method. And now again we have to relax it in some way. So again we relax it in this way. We know parts of p, namely half of the most significant bits, and the lower half is unknown, so we don't know 250 bits, and then we can factor in polynomial time, which was also shown by Coppersmith. And you can also relax this problem to small p and q. Now, small p and q do not really make sense in the factorization setting, so what you do is you write this as p to the r times q, so there are many schemes which uses a module like this, and you can see that in this case, the entropy of your factorization is a little bit smaller, so p and q are smaller, so it's reasonable that your bound drops, so for growing arm, this bound drops. And there are lots of open problems related to this, so it should be even better in this case, p to the r, q to the s, because the entropy is even smaller here, but it's not for this method, so that's really unreasonable. And also for three primes and for non-consecutive bits, it's also not clear how the bounds are. But I want to draw your attention to a different problem. Yes, the previous? Ah, okay. So it works whenever the block of unknown bits is consecutive. So, yes, for D it's not true. For D it's not true. For this one it's true. Okay, if the block of unknown bits is consecutive, because it introduces just one variable, and that's the point. So if it's split in two parts, it introduces two variables, and it's another analysis in the method. But you can deal with it, you get worse bounds, that's it. But it gets worse. And it's somehow unnatural that it gets worse. Well, it should be the same. at least in my opinion. Okay, so now you can ask the question, are these bounds that we have, are they natural, or can we combine them? And if they would be natural, we should combine them in some sense. So what happens, for instance, you can easily compute it, what happens if you have a small d and you know bits of p? Again, you start with this Bonnet-Duffy attack, so we reduce mod e, we have this equation here, which is a polynomial equation, we have two unknowns, and now we start to know bits of p plus q, so this term here decreases in size. Right? So if it's full size, then the size is n to the 1/2, and in this case we get the Bonnet-Duffy bound, and if this term here decreases, so your bound gets better and better, and you see if it drops to zero, the bound gets to d is equal to 1, which is somehow natural. So there's nothing more hidden. And you also see this equation that you get is 1 minus square root of beta, which is somehow a natural function. And I say this because Bonnet and Duffy always said, this is a very unusual point here, 0.292. But in fact, it's a little bit natural, because if you plug in 1/2 here, you end up with this. And in fact, it's also a quadratic function, so it's degree 2, so there should be a square root here. So that's an argument why this is natural. One argument that this is not natural is we already know that if we have half of the bits of p, we can factor in polynomial time. So if we are at this point, we should be able to factor. So at this point, we should jump up here. And this is really unnatural. So my intuition is at least there should be some interpolation here, or maybe here. Or Igor last time told me maybe the interpolation is here, but we don't know. I don't know. But this jump shouldn't occur. So there's an open problem here related to this. But I leave this as an open problem. So related to the small d business is the question whether there is a polynomial at time attack if d itself is not small, but d, which is composed of dp modulo p minus 1 and dq modulo q minus 1, and you choose small dp and dq. This is somewhat interesting because if you use the Chinese remaindering, you raise modulo dp and dq, mod p and q, and then you combine everything with the Chinese remaindering. And well, you see there are also several relaxations for this problem. So the first one was, first observation, it becomes easier if p and q are imbalanced. So, and the more imbalanced they are, the larger is the dp dq that you can attack. And well, here's some result of mine and of Bleichenbacher and myself. The second one is small e, also of Bleichenbacher and myself, which led to the cryptanalysis of two RSA variants where they use small e and small dp and dq in combination. So the message is maybe don't use this in combination, it's a bad idea. And I will show you this attack, and moreover I will show you two more results, namely what happens if we know the difference of these two guys, dp and dq, and this is the recent result of Jochens and myself from AsiaCrypt this year, and again with Ellen Jochens, who will show, you see this result is in the future, it's not quite, it's work in progress somehow. We will show you a bound for the most general case, namely no small e, no known difference, just small dp and dq. And formally the best bound that was known was the square root attack, namely square root of the minimum of both. And now we have a polynomial time attack, which is something like the equivalent of Wiener and Bonnet-Duffy for this case here. I think. Ah, this is also not proven. It's heuristic. It's really, and that's a good point. But it works in practice, so it's an attack, right?
Is the error logic better than finding a 292
experiment? No. You cannot go beyond this. This bound. And you will even see if you do it in practice, you stay below the bound because it's an asymptotic bound. It only holds for n growing to infinity. Right? And you will also see this for these kinds of experiments, we are pretty far away from this bound here. from, well, let's say 73 bits. So what we get in the experiment is about 10 bits, 20 bits, something like this. So it's really, in practice, you cannot really reach these bounds. Also, they are polynomial time.
One last question. How do you motivate DB to sound like that?
Oh, you can motivate it by saying that it's attractive in practice. So if you have small exponents here, you can perform the signature generation very quickly, because then DP well is just a simple small exponent. But for me, I don't see whether anybody uses this in practice. For me, it's just a matter of how strong is this RSA function, and can we give some polynomial time attacks? So I don't care about practice too much. But for motivating and for writing papers, I always say, oh, that's very interesting, because you can do it very quickly, right? Okay, so don't get me wrong. Okay, so let's see these three attacks. So the first one is actually very simple. It's just a linearization attack here. And, well, the others are somewhat derived from this attack. So I'll show you the first one and then derive the other attacks from this. So the setting is the following. DP and DQ are somewhat small. P and Q are the same bit size. So here are the equations that you have. E times dp is 1 modulo p minus 1. E times dq is 1 modulo q minus 1. So we have these two equations. And if you solve for k and l, you see that this is smaller than e times. So we assume that dp is the larger one of both, divided by p minus 1, which is roughly square root of n. Right? So we solve here on both sides for kp and lq, and you see if we solve for these and we multiply these two equations, then p and q disappear because we know they are n. That's nice. So we end up with an equation which is written down here. So you see we have four unknowns, dp dq, this guy here, and this guy here. Right? So we linearize this equation. We have four unknowns, but notice these unknowns are related in some way, but we don't use it in this attack. Okay, so we have four unknowns, w, x, y, and z. We reduce this equation modulo e squared, and then we immediately get a lattice-based attack, because you can just view these as coefficients in your lattice spaces. So here is e. This is 1 minus n is here, and we reduce everything modulo e squared. So you see, if I multiply the rows of this basis here by x naught, y naught, and w naught, I exactly get this relation here in this last column. So I get e times x naught, y times n minus naught, modulo e squared. And you see, if I have this target vector, I get x naught, y naught in these components, and c naught in this component. And of course, if you do it properly, you have to scale here, but I leave out these scaling factors. So it's a well-known heuristic. Again, it's not provable that if the product of all your unknowns is smaller than your modulus, then you can find this target vector as the smallest vector in your lattice. And it's dimension 3, it's not a problem to find the smallest vector. So the sufficient condition is that the product of these three guys is smaller than e squared. And we already have seen that k and l are upper bound by this term here. So the product is upper bound by all the square. And here we get another dp. So we just have to compute it. Here we multiply all upper bounds. And the condition is that they must be smaller than e squared. We just solve it, and you see that we get the condition that tells you that dp must be smaller than n over e to the power 2 over 5. So you already see that in this case, in order to get a non-trivial attack, we have to have that e is smaller than n, and significantly smaller, because otherwise it's a trivial bound. So let's, for instance, assume that n is 1,000 bit, e is 500 bit, so this is a 500 bit number, then dp is about 200 bit in this case. And this was exactly the parameters that were suggested by Goldpress, Hennigan, McKee, and Zan and Wu. Well, not exactly, but almost. So they had 580-bit E and 200-bit DPDQ, and also this here. And we applied. Yes, to copy the. No, this was tested before this attack, and later on they refined their parameter selection, so now they have different parameters. Was that your question? In the first place, these crypto systems were broken by this attack, and later on they refined, so you see it's tunable, so you can somehow refine your things. But be careful with this, because I will show you another attack, and actually it breaks some of the new parameters, so it's I would be very careful to use this in practice. Yeah, tunable means sometimes you can tune it to polynomial time break. Okay, here you see we ran 1,000 experiments to test the heuristic, and you see it's very fast to break it. It's about 50 milliseconds to get the factorization, so it's faster than generating your instances. And you see, this was already very close to the bound, so we get a success rate of 100%. And if we go a little bit beyond the bound, then our success rate drops. And if you go to 210 bits, it drops to zero. So it's really the right bound that we have in this case.
Or same number or different
numbers? Oh, different.
Okay, so it's not true that you can get the same one and
try to make it. Oh, I think it's the same. It shouldn't depend on this. It's the same. You can take the same n. I mean, once you have this n, you can factor it. So there's no point in taking the same n again. Yes. Ah, okay. No, you cannot re-randomize. Oh, that's a good question. Now you're stuck. Then either you have a weak instance or you don't have a weak instance. But actually, these experiments are just for saying that the bound is somehow tied. You cannot do better in practice. And that's the point. So as I already said, is what we do in this attack is we completely linearize it. We do not use that. The unknowns in our equation are somehow related. So you see a dp here and dp here and a k here and a k here. So we do not use this information in the attack. And well, from an attacker's point of view, that's a bad thing. We don't use every information that you have. So the question is, can we use this full information? So what we wish to do is to treat this as a polynomial equation, namely in the unknowns dp, dq, and so on. And what we did first is we fixed this difference here, dpdq, which is c, and well, then we can eliminate one of these variables, so we can write dq as dp, and we only have three variables, dplq, and this makes the thing somewhat easier. So we treat it as a real polynomial equation, and the Newton polytope, which is the set of monomials of this polynomial equation, is defined by this. And the analysis in Coppersmith's method really depends on this Newton polytope. So we carried out the analysis, and the analysis tells us that we can have a polynomial time attack as long as dp and dq are both smaller than this bound. So again, we tested this heuristic attack, and you will see that we get much larger lattices in this case. So here's the attack in practice. We have 1,000-bit n. We should get up to the bound 99 bits in this case, but only if we use sufficiently large dimension for the lattice. And the dimension should be linear in the bit size of this, whatever that means. So there's some constant hidden, but it should be quite large, so maybe a few thousand. And we cannot cope with few thousand dimensional lattice. So we have to see how far we can get in practice. And you see, it's also asymptotic in the sense that it works for larger n, it works a little bit better. So if we double n, it's a little bit better than doubles the bit size. Okay. So here we go up, here's 1,000 bit, here's 1,000 bit for 99 dimension, and you see we already somehow approach the 99, but it will take some time. Okay? And, well, we already said the best thing is use the full polynomial structure. So what we did again is take this equation here, we analyze the full polynomial structure, which gives you an even more complex thing, and trust me, it's really a complex thing to analyze it, and we got up to this bound, and now I have a few experiments for this, for you, and there are some problems. So here you see, in every experiment I use the 1000 bit n, and I write the size of E, and maybe the most interesting part is 1000 bits, so full size E in this case. You see the asymptotic bound that we get is 0.073. that was the bound that we had before, and in the experiments we only get up to 11 bits instead of 73 bits. But there's a thing, so we use a lattice of dimension 144. And the analysis that we have tells us that in this dimension, we should only go up to 4 bits instead of 11 bits. So the question is our analysis too bad? So it gives us a bound, but it's not clear whether it's the right bound. And if you really look into the lattices, you see that the collection that we chose so far is not the right collection. Namely, the L-cube algorithm takes a subset of our collection. But actually, at the moment, we don't know what is the right subset and how to analyze the subset, because we have to analyze the determinants in this case. So it's not clear whether this bound here is the right one. And you see, here, it's far away from this bound. So that one is the asymptotic bound. This one is the bound that we should get for this dimension here. So we should get 227 bits, but we get something which is a factor about 3 over 2 apart from this, and it's even better than the asymptotic bound. So there's some hope that this is not the right bound. But, well, in practice, you see, it will be quite tough, so it will be out of reach to do this with 10,000 bit n, you will see. So it really depends how stable your L-cube algorithm is. These are the experimental results so far, and you might say, well, isn't it annoying if you have a new polynomial to do this whole Coppersmith analysis anew? So, and if you ask this question, you are completely right. So the nice thing would be to have a polynomial. You start with some polynomial, and you want to find the optimal bounds for this polynomial, which means you want to find an optimal lattice basis, and you want to find this automatically. So you just plug in your algorithm, you give it this polynomial, and your algorithm outputs you the upper bounds. And this would be nice. So this question is solved for univariate modular case. In this case, it's quite easy, but it already becomes a little bit tricky in the bivariate case. So there's a joint paper with Johannes Blömer, where we analyze several bounds depending on the Newton polytope that you have. And well, for arbitrary number of polynomials, at least we have some strategies how to handle it. But it's not clear at all whether it gives you the optimal bound or not. So, and actually, that's also work in progress with Damian Stehle. What we try to do is we try to define an algorithm that, given as input such an F, computes the optimal bound. And the deal is just put in every polynomial up to a certain degree. That's what you do in Krippner-based as well, and then you select your right sublattice from this. And, well, the question is whether this will work or not is the question whether a tube will work in very large dimensions or not. And
what does it mean to say algebra output optimal
bound? The bound depends on the collection of your... the upper bounds for x1, xn, and so on. So whenever you do this analysis, you get an upper bound for your unknowns. So let's think of small d, you get an upper bound d smaller than 0.292. So that's your unknown, and, well, you want to do this automatically. So given a polynomial, this algorithm would upper bound you every single variable in your polynomial. Normally, the the variables in your polynomial are somehow related. So you just get maybe one upper bound. That's a good question. So normally the upper bounds are of the type x1, on by x1 I mean this, x1 times x2 is smaller than n, for instance. So you get, in fact, a balance. So you can choose a smaller x1, then you enlarge your x2. So they are related in some way, that's true. And this is the type that you get. Okay? So let's conclude this. So what you have seen is the first polynomial time attack for us, ACRT. It's not yet finished. There are some open questions, and it's not clear whether it's the best bound that we can get. So the good point is that the theoretical analysis is worse than the experiments in a certain sense, because it predicts that you can not go so far. And, we have some bounds that do not match. So, for instance, we had a bound on small d and factoring with known bits, and it didn't match because you had this jump in this graph. And we also have a bound which does not match, which I did not mention. So I had a bound where the difference was fixed. So let's assume that the difference is zero in this case. In this case, you are in the same case as a small d, but you don't get this Bonnie-Duffy thing. So this is somehow unnatural. You should get Bonnie-Duffy in this case. And there's a need for giving provable version of Kupper-Smith method. And their first approach is how to do this. I think this is the right thing to do. And, there's a need to automate this bound analysis. I hope this will be done, in a few months, maybe. Okay, so.